Please give your attention to Brother John Mulholland as he leads us in his class entitled Samuel the Prophet.
Samuel the Prophet, or Samuel the Seer, part one, before he was old. If we turn them for a moment to Jeremiah chapter 15 and verse 1, we come across one of the very few references to Jeremiah that are outside the book, to Samuel that are outside the book of Samuel. And in this reference, we have Jeremiah being told concerning the end of the kingdom of Israel. Then the Lord said unto me, though Moses and Samuel stood before me, yet my mind could not be toward this people. Cast them out of my sight and let them go forth. And in verse 4, I will cause them to be removed into all kingdoms of the earth because of Manasseh, for that which he did in Jerusalem. Moses, the lawgiver, unto Samuel the seer, describes the time period when Israel was a national entity. From the time of Moses, when they were brought forth to enter the land of the Lord's rest, to be a priestly nation with a holy law, with the tabernacle of God's presence among them, for them how to worship the living God of heaven and earth. And it carries on to the time of the kings and the kingdom of Israel, whom Samuel anoints and sets the laws of the king and kingdom and worship within the temple for worshiping the living God. And in Jeremiah's day, the last king would reign as the kingdom established under Samuel would come to its end. For the kingdom had sunk to the depths of depravity, epitomized in Manasseh's corruption of worship in Jerusalem, the city where the Lord put his name and where his presence dwelt amongst his people. And if we think of Samuel's time, we realize that he is right in the middle of the time from Moses going to Egypt to bring forth the people to this time that Jeremiah is warning them of the pending doom. He's around the year 1050, give or take. And we have 14, maybe 80 or 90 B.C. for Moses and the children of Israel. And we have 600 B.C. for the time of the kingdom finally being taken into captivity. So he's right in the middle. And there is the pivotal point where it switches from God ruling as their king to his regent, a king upon earth, ruling upon a throne over his people. Everything here is described in the terms of those two great servants, Moses and Samuel. And we must remember that Moses introduced the judges to Israel. He did that before the law was given at Sinai. He did it at the insistence of his father-in-law, Jethro, who watched him judging the matters of the people. And so he appointed judges over tens and fifties, hundreds and thousands. And that carried on, we're told, until Samuel was the last judge. And we're told that he was the last judge, basically, when he was old. For then, he was to anoint a king. Not the king that God would give them, but the king that the people wanted. Significantly, in the book of Judges of Israel, when Israel lived in the land, beginning with the first generation who you might say were born in the land. They actually, many of them were not, but they are the third generation from those brought out of Egypt. Their hallmark was expressed in a phrase: in those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And the people sought a king when Samuel was old that would be right in their eyes. And the Lord gave them their desire. They gave them Saul, an Israelite of Benjamin, a man of the very tribe all Israel had despised. Despised so greatly that they had obliterated Benjamin out of the sons of Israel. They just missed getting the last 600 men. And that occurred probably something like 40 years after they had entered the land under Joshua. So we're going to be considering Samuel the seer in two basic parts. Part one is matters before he was old, and part two, matters when he was old. So before he was old, Samuel chapters 1, 2, and 3 are about Samuel's first 20 years of life. It begins with Hannah's petition for an eternal Nazarite son. Not just a son, but an eternal Nazarite son, which if she was given that son, she would give it back to the Lord to be his all the days of his life. She would give it back to the Lord to be the Lord's son, Nazarite's son. And then we're told of his conception and of his birth, of his weaning, and of his presentation as a child to the Lord. And then we're told of Hannah's prayer concerning the Lord's Nazarite son. Then we're told of the boy Samuel, who hears the voice of the Lord and is told of the judgment upon the house of Eli concerning the raising of a faithful priest that would do all according to the Lord's heart. And he told him, I will perform against Eli all things which I have spoken concerning his house. When I begin, I will also make an end. And then we have him basically as a teenager, a time when the ark is taken and never returns again to the tabernacle. And Samuel, we're told, grew. We're told that the Lord was with him, and the Lord let none of his words fall to the ground. And we're told that all Israel, from Dan even to Beersheba, knew that Samuel was established a prophet of the Lord. And then we move into chapters 4 to chapter 7, describing the taking of the Ark of the Covenant. And Samuel's not mentioned here. And we come to chapter 7, verse 2, and we're told of the one incident in the life of Samuel as a man, a young man. It's Israel's first deliverance from the dominion of the Philistines, after which we're told they never again were able to control Israel like they had in the days of Saul and those before. And Israel regained much of their territory. And then there is the conclusion to Samuel's life before he was old. And that comes at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 7, verses 15 to 17. And it's summed up in this way. Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, going from year to year in circuit to Bethel and Gilgal and Mizpah, and returning to Ha-Ramatah, returning to the land around Ramah. For there was his house, and there he judged Israel, and there he built an altar unto the Lord. And there are many anomalies in Samuel's life, and they're expressed here. Samuel is a Levite. He's living in a non-Levitical city. He's a Nazarite. We know his life. He acts as a priest. He's built an altar unto the Lord, and sacrifices are there. He acts like a priest. But he doesn't do that where the Ark of the Covenant was. That was off to the east. He doesn't do that up at the tabernacle itself, because that was to the north. Samuel is a seer or a prophet, and he's a judge to all Israel out of this place called Ramah. And that is the Samuel the seer we seek to unveil from the scriptural record of 1 Samuel, 1 Chronicles 6, Psalm 99, Acts 13, and Hebrews 11. Records pertaining to the time before he was old. And we can see them on the screen there, summarized for us just as we've gone through them. So where we want to go now then is to 1 Chronicles chapter 6. And here it's at verses 22 to 28. And here we're given the sons of Kohath, the son of Levi. It's a genealogy of the sons of Kohath until the sons of Samuel. And in this genealogy, we are told of three Elkanahs descended from Kohath. We can see them in the various verses there. Verse 23 is one of them. Again in verse 26 and in verse 27. And from the last of those three Elkanahs, we have Samuel, for that is his father. So he's a Levite descended from Korah, whose duties had to do with the holy things of the tabernacle, very especially with the Ark of the Covenant, which for most of Samuel's life was not in the tabernacle. Samuel is not descended from Aaron, as we obviously see. Therefore, he's not a priest by descent. He can only act as a priest because he's an eternal Nazarite from before his conception until his death, which was the prayer of his mother to have a son. So now we come to verses 33 to 38. Now this is a different list. Same persons, but it's given a different way. We're having now the singers before the temple in Jerusalem of the sons of Kohath, who was the son of Levi. And one of the three principal groups we find is descended from Shemuel, which is Samuel. Same Hebrew word, same Hebrew vowel pointing. It's referring to him. Thus Samuel, whose words were always heard of the Lord, is perpetuated in the temple worship which Samuel inaugurates and gives to David. And it's done by one of the three groups of singers being his descendant. It's a fitting witness to later generations of Samuel the seer, the servant of the Lord, the Nazarite son of the Lord, heard daily by the Lord in their singing before the temple. And here we note an emphasis is on how families were known. And I have highlighted them there, as you can see. Families are known usually through their father's name, especially through some exploit of particular ancestors of note. And notable in the list are Shemuel, Zuf, Amasai, Korah, Kohath, Levi, and Israel. The Elkanahs are known by their respective ancestral fathers, Zuf, Amasai, and Korah. Then there are notable circumstances of some of these ancestors. Shemuel, who we are considering, the last judge, the first of the prophets, etc. There's Zuf, whom his father is specifically named to be descended from. There's Korah, the great rebellion. There's Kohath, unto whom we have the distribution of the Levitical duties going unto him as one-third of the Levites. Of course, there's Levi, the son of Jacob. Certainly, Jacob, who was called Israel. The Elkanahs are known by the names of their fathers. And that's the way we would refer to them. We have before us Heman and Joel. They're Shemuelites, or Samuelites, if you wanted to refer them to their first well-known ancestor. And Elkanah, he's a Zufite. Yeah, next Elkanah, he's an Amasite. And the first Elkanah, he's a Korathite. And Korah and his brother Izhar, they're Kohathites. And Kohath is a Levite. And all his descendants are known as Levites. And of course, all of Levi's descendants are known as Israelites. It's a way of expressing them in terms of their parentage and notable events. And of special interest to us are those Zufites, for Samuel is a Zufite. So we'll now come to the book of 1 Samuel chapter 9. We're going to slide in between the daily Bible reading comments here. And we're not overlapping each other. Is genealogy and home. It's about Zuf, the Zufites, Ramah, Benjamin, and Mount Ephraim. And of course, it is a story of asses that have gone astray from their owner's land. Animals, when they stray from their owner's land, we must remember they're very used to that land and used to their daily routines. And when they stray for certain reasons, pasture and water. And they don't stray long distances. That's very, very unusual. They stray randomly about their normal area that they are familiar with. And we're told in 1 Samuel 9, verse 20, that Saul had been hunting for his father's asses for 3 days when he comes to this place called Ramah. Now, we're told that as he searched. He searched all of Benjamin. We're not told that he searched any other land. He didn't search the patrimony of Ephraim to the north, and he didn't go down south into Judah. The record speaks of him passing through Mount Ephraim, whatever may be meant by that phrase, going through the land of Shalisha, going to the land of Shalem. Of course, we have the phrase, the land of the Benjamites. And it concludes saying the asses were not found. And then it goes on to say that to bring now Samuel and contacting Saul, it brings up this point that he goes into the land called the land of Zuph, as he wants to return to his home in Gibeah. And these are all within Benjamin, within the land of the Benjamites. None of these phrases say he went into the patrimony of Ephraim or into the patrimony of Judah, the two adjoining lands of the sons of Israel. So we have those notes on the wall, and we will add this. The land of Shalisha is in Benjamin. And we would say it's the land occupied by the descendants of Shalisha. It's a big area, and his family's spreading out in it. They're staying within their patrimony. They're all considered to be the land of Shalisha, and they're all descendants from them, and they're all living in that area. Now, the same for Shalem, for the descendants of whoever is this Shalem. And the summary statement is that Saul and his servant did not find the asses as they passed through all the land of Benjamin. And then we're given a specific, specific comment, like we're often given in the Bible, where we're now given further information as he enters the land of Zuph, which would be that which would be of the descendants of whoever this Zuph is. And he goes to a city where a seer lives. We find out that that is Ramah, where Samuel is. Now, why are we interested in this? You'll find that in commentaries, there are two locations given for this particular city and for the city where Samuel's parents lived. And there's a reason we want to look at this for part two when it comes to the anointing of Saul. Now, the one is in Ephraim. The other is here in Benjamin. And they assign a name to the one in Ephraim, and they take it right from 1 Samuel 1:1, Ramathaim Zophim, and the phrase Mount Ephraim. But it adds something else at the end that raises a little bit of a problem, that Zuph was an Ephrathite, not an Ephraimite. Two different meanings. You also want to point out that there's quite a distance involved, roughly 20 miles from where Saul's family lived in Gibeah, up to this place that has been guessed as to where it is and what it is by scholars as being Ramathaim Zophim. And this is what most scholars state. But others say the phrase should not be transliterated. It should be translated into English, for it gives a clarifying statement concerning Elkanah's residence and genealogy. And so we wonder, how far did Saul travel? How many square miles did he cover in 3 days? To go up there, you're talking several hundred square miles of territory. But to stay within Benjamin, you're talking something someone can do in a 3-day period and still not find their asses. So So now we're going to come to consider Joshua chapter 21 at verse 9. Now, this is the beginning of the record of the various cities given to the priests and to the Kohathites, the Levites from which Samuel is descended. Verses 9 to 19 are the priests. And we can see that they're in Judah and Benjamin, 13 cities. Ramah's not named there. So let's then look down at verses 20 to 26, because now this is where the sons of Kohath go. Interesting. They're in Ephraim's land, Dan's land, and Manasseh's. The only ones that are in Benjamin and Judah's territory are the priests. And this is where Kohath's descendants are made to live in the Levitical cities. Shechem, Bethor, but no Ramah. And that's interesting. Why would Samuel's parents, who are so enthused in keeping the law of God and worshiping God rightly, why are they living in a non-Levitical area they're not supposed to be living in? Why would Samuel choose to stay in later life and build an altar in a non-Levitical city after the ark had been taken from the tabernacle? Why would there be a land called the land of Zuph, land owned by Zuph? The word does mean honeycomb, but how often do we call land around here the land of honeycomb, the land of bees, the land of birds? We'll refer to the land of, well, when we drive home, we go to the land of McDonald's. It's a large farm nearby us. And we're used to that. And that would seem the more logical thing. So something has happened over time that has caused this person, Zuph, to own land in Benjamin, where there's a huge family of Levites living, of which Samuel is going to be part of that family. So we'll move on then to look at the map of the Levitical cities. And these are pretty well located by scholars, and people are quite certain of most of their locations. The white ones, they are in areas they think that they're located at. The black dots or the red ones are definitely, no questions asked, locations. The location of Ramathaim Zophim that scholars speak about is right here in the E of the word Ephraim. There's nothing around it. Come into Ramah, right here in the center of Benjamin. And of course, the priests are all around it. But that's all. That's all we can see. But it appears that Samuel's forebears were given a home in Dan, Ephraim, or Manasseh, but never in Benjamin. And later, for some reason, they purchased land in Benjamin, and there they moved. Now we wonder then, how could they do this and why? Because the inheritance belongs to Benjamites, not Levites. Why would they have a home in a fortified city of Benjamin? Because it was a major fortified city all its time. A city that was never given to any descendant of Levi. Well, in Numbers chapter 26, if you turn there, you will find another record about the land of Benjamin. Numbers 26, verses 38 to 41, gives the sons of Benjamin after their families who were to inherit land. And they were to do it according to their families. And there are seven men named. And, of course, those descended from Bela were told in verse 30, they're Belalites. And of Ashbel, they're Ashbelites. And of Ahiram, they're Ahiramites. Well, if they were of Zuph, they would be Zuphites. They're known by the specific family breakdown at the time of the giving out of who would inherit by their families. And, of course, their land would then be known as the land of Bela, the land of Ashbel, Hiram, Ard, Naaman. That's the way they would be known. And they would be given a large tract of land. And then the rest of them inside that family would be given plots here, there, and everywhere to use up the whole land. They would have that one large section, say, known as the land of Bela. And if he has 400 descendants, they got 400 little parcels in there. And the Belalites would live there, and that would be the land of the Belalites. Very straightforward. We're told that there were 45,600 men who were numbered of Benjamin, which means they had a total of 45,600 parcels of land that would eventually be divided amongst the seven families of the Benjamites according to the men of war as they each became married and raising their families. And we're told in Joshua chapter 18, verses 11 to 28, that it's according to their families. According to their families, according to their names. Well, that brings up then, how do we answer this question of these Levites owning Ramah and the surrounding area as a land of Zuph? Something must have happened to the inheritance of Benjamin. And that comes in Judges chapters 17 and 18 and Judges chapters 19 and 21. They're at the end of the book of Judges, but they belong in chapter 2. Judges 17 and 18 is about Moses' grandson and the creation of another priesthood, one in Dan, that existed until the captivity. So 400 years after Samuel. Existed for almost 700 years. And Judges chapter 19 and 21 is about Aaron's grandson, Phinehas. And it's about the extermination of the Benjamites. The first generation out of Egypt died in the wilderness. The second generation entered the land, of whom it is written in Judges chapter 2, starting at verse 6, Joshua let the people go, the children of Israel went every man unto his inheritance to possess the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua. That's that second generation. The next generation has as its elders men like Jonathan, grandson of Moses, and Phinehas, grandson of Aaron. And of their generation, we're told in Joshua chapter 2 at verse 10, there arose another generation after them. This is their generation, they're the elders of, which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Balaam, and they forsook the Lord God of their fathers. And of that generation, what happened in detail is found in Judges 17 and 18 and in 19 to 21. So there they are. We have here Jonathan on the left, and we have Phinehas over here. And here is where all that remained were 600 men who are related to 600 parcels of ground out of 45,600 when they were initially distributed. But now, they return, and their land has been utterly devastated. There's not a chicken, goat, sheep, cow, no heifers. There's no crops. There's no buildings. There's no vineyards. There's nothing. They scorched the land. We're told that in the book of Judges. They destroyed Benjamin utterly and completely. They did more to them in destroying them than they did to the Canaanites. So they returned to their land and were told that they rebuilt. What did they rebuild? All 45,600 parcels of all of Benjamin, 600 of them? What did they have to build with? We're not told that they were given a thing other than each of them was gotten a wife. So they were destitute. They went back to rebuild. Now, if we take a look at the laws regarding redemption of land of those who have died, et cetera, we find there's quite a bit of confusion in them, but they're all in there. And there are certain little comments that are made, one of which is land that's sold, if it's not redeemed, or if it's sold a second time, it could not be redeemed back into the tribe which had sold it. That's interesting. And that does not say a Levite could not do it. Zoph, a Levite, appears to have bought land in Benjamin, which is known as the land of Zoph, where his progeny lived, and wherein was a fenced city called Ramah, the permanent home of Samuel and of his parents. So Zoph or his forebears moved from wherever their Levitical city was into an area only allotted to the priests, who were the only ones who were to live in the land of Benjamin and the land of Judah. Something happened after this incident of the devastation of the tribe of Benjamin. And it opens up for why you would see Levites there. Remembering, no king in the land, they did whatever was right in their eyes. And to them, get a chunk of land, permanently ours. Now we come to this word, Ephraimite and Ephrathite. Both are used. They have the same vowel points, same Hebrew letters. In Judges chapter 12, verse 5, we're told of Jephthah's fight with Ephraim and of what happened at the passages of Jordan. And the men of Ephraim are there spoken of as Ephraimites. They couldn't pronounce a certain word. They couldn't. They knew they were Ephraimites and they were slaughtered. Then we find this word shows up several other times. And it's always an Ephrathite. 1 Samuel 1 and 1, of course, that's Zuph, a Levite who's known as an Ephrathite. 1 Samuel 17, verse 12, David, a Judahite, he's known as an Ephrathite. Ruth 1, verse 2, Elimelech, Naomi, Mahlon, and Chilion, they're all Judahites, but they're referred to as Ephrathites. So we have land that is called the land of Ephraim. We have land known as Mount Ephraim. We have people called Ephraimites. And we have people called Ephraimites who are not, Ephrathites who are not Ephraimites. I'm getting tongue-tied. Now the Hebrew word means fruitful. And the Ephraimites were so named by Joseph when his second son was born in Genesis 41 and 52. That's where they get their name from, because he was fruitful. The land of Ephraim is not a single mount. There is a Mount Ephraim in Ephraim. There's also a place called Mount Ephraim, which does not show on our Bible maps normally. But the Mount Ephraim that is spoken of, that we have marked on our maps, is about 15 miles northeast of Ramathaim Zophim location that the scholars have located, just north of Shiloh. And it's more than 20 miles north of Ramah, which is in Benjamin. Now we're told that Rachel was buried in the way of Ephrath. Same word, the Hebrew prefix letter signifying of, in the way of Ephrath, on the way to Bethlehem. Our English Bibles infer it applies to only the immediate area of Bethlehem and Judah, but the Hebrew indicates it's in the way from Bethel to Bethlehem, and it's called the way of fruitfulness. So, Mount Ephraim. Ephraim means fruitful. Israel's Mount of Fruitfulness. Well, here's a model of the topography of the land that was made and a photograph of it. And, of course, Jerusalem would be up in here, and Ramah would be here, and Ramathaim would be over here, and Shiloh would be up there, and this is Mount Carmel here, and the Valley of Jezreel here. But this whole thing here is known as Mount Ephraim. Ephraim up here, Benjamin, and Judah, and Simeon. They're all in it. It's a mountain area with a specific name for a reason. Like that area there. And the southern portion of Mount Ephraim is the way of Ephrathah, the way of fruitfulness, spoken of in Genesis, in this area. But it applies to the overall all area. It's the area of which the 12 spies made their report on, in Numbers 13, where we're told at verse 27, "We came unto the land whither thou sendest us, and surely it floweth with milk and honey. And this is the fruit of it." That was their report. It's fruitfulness. And we're told in verse 21, the spies had gone up and searched the land from the wilderness of Zin unto Rehob as men come to Hamath. And they ascended by the south and came unto Hebron. So they came up out of down here, and they come up through Hebron, all the way up, and on up, way up here. And then they return back down. And we're told that, of course, it was the time of first ripe grapes when they went. And they came back in the point of the main harvest of the grapes. And we're told that they came under the brook Eshcol and cut down from thence a branch with one cluster of grapes, and they bear it between two upon a staff. One cluster of grapes? That's a lot of grapes if you have to carry it on two men's shoulders. And they brought of the pomegranates and of the figs, all these fruits they brought back. This is what they found walking the mount called Mount Ephraim, the mount of fruitfulness from Hebron northward up to Rehob and back, the way of Ephrath, which Jacob walked southward toward Bethlehem, and along which he buried Rachel after he had left Bethel. Bethlehem Judah has another name, Bethlehem Ephrathah, the house of fruitful bread, because it's in that area. It's in that trek. Bethlehem is but one city, though, of Mount Ephraim. The way of Ephrath is to walk north to south or south to north up that mountain ridge of the fruitfulness of the land of Israel. I have never been there, but people who have been have said you can see the fruitfulness of that land in that area. All it needs is water, and she bursts forth. And it's exactly as it was described to Moses in Exodus 3, verse 8. A good land and a large, a land flowing with milk and honey. Milk, good land for their flocks that produce milk. Honey, a land of blossom, fruit of all kinds, from which honey would be made. Grapes, pomegranates, figs, etc., found by them. So why all that? Well, that was just to get us to the point to realize where Samuel's living, because there are two different places that are argued. You'll find them in different books. We have them in different writings of our own, two different locations. I thought it would be good to go through what information we have here to see what we have available and what it would apparently be. So that brings us to 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1. Who are the parents of Samuel, and what is being referred to here in this verse? We're now getting in to talk about Samuel himself directly. Now there was a certain man of Ramathaim, Zophim of Mount Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jehoram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephrathite. And that's the Hebrew, and you can see it, and if you would compare it to the slide we had before, you would pick out the Ephrathite and Ephraim, and you can see the letters, how they all match up as we had before. And they have the same vowel pointings throughout the Masoretic texts. So we could translate it into English, and we would have, and exists a certain man of the Ramathites, someone who lives in Ramah, Zophs of Mount Ephraim. There are the descendants of Zoph in Mount Ephraim, the mount of fruitfulness. His name is Elkanah. Which Elkanah? We got three of them. He's a Levite. We got to figure out who he is. He's the son of Jehoram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, the land of Zoph. An Ephrathite, someone who lives in the area of fruitfulness, Mount Ephraim, the Mount of Fruitfulness. So we could say, with quite a degree of certainty, I think, that Elkanah is an inhabitant of Ramah. He's a descendant of the Zoph family of Ephrathah. His family's land is known as the land of Zoph, which is part of the area known as Ephrathah, which is part of the area known as Mount Ephraim, which part of Mount Ephraim is in the inheritance of Benjamin. And that puts the Ramah 2 miles from Saul's hometown of Gibeah. And that becomes of great interest when you have the meeting of Samuel and Saul and of the story of his anointing and of all the incidents that occur there. They all revolve around those two town names in the books of Judges and the book of Samuel, which we will look at is when we look at the section when he was old. So now we come to Samuel's name. This is in verse 20. Wherefore it came to pass when the time was come about, after Hannah had conceived, that she bare a son and called his name Samuel, saying, because I have asked him of the Lord. Interestingly, there are two definitions of the name. Different scholars have different reasons. The usual one is, she said, because I have asked him of the Lord. Therefore, it has, like in my margin here, it says, asked of God, is what it means. But the Hebrew name, if you really look at it compared to the other buildups of names that are asked of God, you find that this one doesn't quite match the way in which the Hebrew constructs the names. And it constructs it instead in the form God, his name. And of course we know that there is one who had that name. He shall be called the Mighty God. Speaking of the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, our point is going to be this. What really did Hannah ask of the Lord? Right now we have here these different forms. God, his name, God hears. Notice how it's different. Here, the Lord hears. Here, God of petition. You see how they're constructed. So, she asked something. And her petition, and it's a very interesting word for petition, it's a pleading petition. It's one from deep within the heart. Not used very often. She pleaded for a specific type of son to be given to her, to be given back to the Lord as a Nazarite all his life. So the son the Lord gives her, she gives back to the Lord as the Lord's son, a Nazarite all his life. How could she say that? Well, first of all, in chapter 1, verse 11, we're told that the very first words of her prayer were, she vowed a vow. So she's taken a vow. And she took a vow of a Nazarite. Her vow was for a Nazarite son that would be the Lord's Nazarite son all the days of his life. How could she expect to be able to say that the child given to her would be a Nazarite, would be a Nazarite all his life until the day he died? None of us would go and guarantee that of any of our children. So she knew that what she was asking was that God would give her a specific child that would be just that. That's what she was asking for. She was asking for one like unto the one promised in Genesis 3 and 15. And her prayer, which we read, when she presented Samuel to the Lord at the Lord's house to be raised in the Lord's presence by the high priest of the Lord, it's all about that son being the Lord's deliverance of his people. And it ends on the note in verse 10, the Lord shall judge the ends of the earth. The Lord shall give strength unto his king. What king? No one's asked for a king. No one's talked about a king. It only appears in the last words of Moses, a reference to a king. And she says that the Lord will exalt the horn of his anointed, his Messiah. First time it appears in the scripture. And that's the whole point that leads into the life of Samuel from the book of Judges. And it's what Samuel's life is all about. The end of the judges and the beginning of the king. And we're told that the Lord remembered her. And that means he remembered her vow. And he gave her a son to fulfill that vow. And that son's life foreshadowed the Messiah that would judge all the world, that God would bring in his promise to David. And Mary's prayer as the Lord's handmaid to bring forth the Messiah is Hannah's prayer. It's marked in every Bible you can buy that has any reference marks. They will all refer you, the two of them are referred to each other, the entire prayers. So we know exactly what that prayer is about. And it's obvious to everyone who reads the Bible. And we know that Samuel's life is a record of a life without sin, without guile in his mouth. We know that the Lord lived a life of no sin, no guile in his mouth. Both throughout their life are shown. His record is always doing the will of God. And the Son of God, I come to do thy will. So that is what she asked for. And that would infer that the proper terminology for his name is really God, his name, or his name is God. He was heard by God of everything he asked, just as Jesus was. And Jesus heard everything the Father told him, and Samuel heard everything that the Lord told him. That's obvious from the records of their lives. But it would appear that a more proper terminology for his name is God, or God his name, rather than asked or hearing. Samuel's seat of judging Israel, and that's in 1 Samuel chapter 7. These are all the various judges that are listed, and here is Samuel in this location. All the other judges judged in their local areas. They were involved with the people in their areas like that. But Samuel is different. He's in the center of the country, and we're told all Israel was judged by him, and all Israel came to him, and at his death, all Israel mourned him. Very different to all the other judges. And we're told he went year to year in circuit. And there is the circuit, Bethel, Gilgal, Mizpah, and Ramah. Put it on a compass. Bethel is to the north, Gilgal is to the east, Ramah is to the south, and Mizpah is to the west. And it's given in a clockwise direction, but because there's special emphasis on Ramah, that comes last. But it moves around northeast, it's almost like northeast southwest. There's another reference to this, and that's in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32. And it's the conclusion to the list of the faithful names in Hebrews 11. The writer has closed the list of the faithful with Moses, and a Canaanite woman. He drops out Joshua. He speaks of the taking of Jericho, but Joshua isn't mentioned. Rahab is. So he's taken the faithful, Moses, a Hebrew, and the harlot Rahab, a Gentile, of those that were to be utterly destroyed from the face of the earth. And it's done with a group of men, seven in total. Six are named by their specific names, and the seventh by a group. And they're listed as Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David also, and Samuel, and the prophets. And that's the way it's presented to us by that writer. And these are the names, and they come in, interestingly, counterclockwise. Gideon, Barak, north, west, south, and ends up in the east. I thought that was curious. And Hebrew 11 begins, as did Psalm 99 and 6, with Moses being the beginning of the national entity of Israel, and Samuel being said to be the closing end of the time of the national entity of Israel. And that pivotal emphasis has appeared in his circuit and in the circuit of the faithful. And with our time being where it is, we will stop there and leave the rest of it to another class.